Good morning. It is always a pleasure to be able to do a college Sunday, and I'm just so thankful, and really am a blessed man to have a college ministry full of students who love God and are, they really enjoy using their gifts and abilities to praise God. You get to taste a little bit of that today. I get to see it every week, and I'm just thankful for this group, this college ministry that we have, the students that are in it, their love for Christ, their desire not to just be a clique, but their desire to impact this church as well and to involve themselves. And we are a blessed church to have them. I just want to give them public acknowledgement for that. If you can turn to Psalm 95, that is our text for today. And we will be looking also in the Old Testament and some other places. But Psalm 95 is a really, really great psalm. It's one of my favorites as I've been studying through it. Psalm 95. The title is Trusting God in Trying Times. And if you look at this picture, you might be tempted to think that's Palmdale. And that's not Palmdale. That's actually the wilderness of Sinai. It's the desert in which the Israelites traveled for 40 years in. It's a dry and desolate place. And I picked this psalm because it's something that I've been studying personally, and it's something that's impacted me. And I hope it does the same for you. If you are a news watcher or a news reader. A lot of people get their news now on the internet. But if you watch the news, if you read the news, really what you find is a picture of gloom and doom. You can't turn on the television for long without some aspect of our faltering economy come into play. In fact, just recently you've seen the three big automakers pleading for $25 billion from the Senate. I would like to plead money from the Senate. I think that'd be, I don't know if they'd give it to me, but I'd like to do that. The economy is in this scary downward spiral. People are losing their houses. People are losing their jobs. I just read yesterday that President-elect Obama has said that millions of jobs are in jeopardy. Now, that's scary news. And his advisors put out a statement recently to temper expectations on the Obama administration. So that change that you were really excited about, temper those expectations. Because 2009 is going to be harder than even where we're at. Economists are looking at the economy as being maybe 2 years away from righting itself. Some say even five. Gloom and doom. Unemployment is, the numbers are at its highest in 16 years. So the forecast is bleak. The world's economy is just as erratic and in trouble. Japan's exports are causing that economy to be upside down. China, who has a relatively strong economy, is now closing down factories. It's called for global response. If you've paid attention to some of the obscure news, you'll notice that some of the high-end leaders in the different countries are calling for a global economy. Now, think about that. A global economy is not too far off from a one-world government. Global problems need global solutions. It really is a depressing picture that is before us every day. Trusting God in trying times is, I think, a very pertinent topic. But I can't start a sermon like that. It's just not me. So I want to give you one bright spot. One bright spot in all the doom and gloom. Spam. Spam. It's not being bombarded with emails. The actual spam, that 12-ounce gelatinous gook that people wonder, what is this? It's the modern version of manna. I don't know what this is. I think it might be meat, but I'm not sure. That mystery meat. Spam is at its highest in sales. Isn't that exciting? Think about that. It is, spam sales are skyrocketing because in troubled times, in difficult economic times, people want to buy the cheapest thing. And if it seems like it might be meat and it's cheap, then we'll buy that. In fact, food chains are now being developed all pertaining to spam. Now, some people really like spam, and there's other people that look at it. And I'm not too much of a guy who, when you open the can and it goes on your plate, and it's still in the shape of the can, that scares me. But there are restaurants. Johnny's Spamorama is one that took note. I was reading this whole article on spam. It's fascinating. And there's spam burgers and spam pizza. The thing that interested me the most, I never want to try it, but I was just intrigued, was spam brownies. And I don't get that. But apparently the person that was interviewed said it was the best thing they've ever had. And I'm not sure that I would even want to go that route. But, you know, if you're really challenged in this economic downturn, think of spam. That might lift your spirits. Or we could be reminded to place our trust in God. Because oftentimes in the most difficult situations, the most difficult circumstances will test whether or not we trust truly in God. I am preaching this not because there's a meeting going on second hour, this hour, to determine whether we're going to have a worship pastor or not. This is just God's sovereign design. I have been wrestling through my own life about what my future holds. And as I started wrestling through that, I started studying on my own Psalm 95 and the wilderness generation. And that's really what Psalm 95 is going to look back to, is that wilderness generation. And so I come to you not as one who's mastered trust in God. That is for sure. I come to you as someone who oftentimes struggles with his own trust and wondering, what is my future? Where will I be? Will I be here? I want to be here. I want to die here. Hopefully not soon, but I want to die in this church. Hopefully not preaching either. Will Steph and I ever be able to afford a home? Will we be able to have children? Where will we be in this economic spiral? Some people deal with the financial aspect and they're struggling. People are losing their retirement funds. Imagine putting all that you've earned for years and years and years only to see that dwindle away. Houses are being taken, jobs are being lost. People are struggling physically, not just financially. People are struggling with relationships. Trusting God, I think, is a very good topic. And so I don't bring this as one who's mastered. I bring it, in a sense, as something that I'm learning and that excites me. And this psalm, I hope by the end of it, this psalm and the examples that we're going to look at in the wilderness generation, that actually excites you to want to trust God. That it paints a big picture of God to grab a hold of. Pray with me as we begin. Father, we are humbled by the fact that you care and love and provide for us. In a world that is uncertain, we know that you are certain. In difficult times, we know that we can trust you. But Father, oftentimes we fail in that. I pray, Father, that as we open up this psalm and we look at the wilderness generation and their examples, that we would be challenged yet changed, that we would be encouraged and transformed, that we would be reminded often of who you are. In your Son's name, amen. Psalm 95. It's written by David. The thing that I love about the Psalms is that in quite often there's a backdrop to it, a backstory about a psalm. Now, some psalms you come to, there's nothing. It just there it is, and you understand it, you read it, and you can interpret it. But oftentimes, the psalms will have something in the background to help you understand it even more. Some of the psalms are by David, who is running away from Saul, and you get to see in the accounts that parallel that, just some of the things he's going through as he writes it. Well, this psalm is written by David, and this psalm is written to David's generation to worship and obey God, and looking at the previous generation and how they failed at that. Let's read it. O come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before His presence with thanksgiving. Let us shout joyfully to Him with psalms. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods, in whose hand are the depths of the earth. The peaks of the mountains are His also. The sea is His, for it was He who made it. And His hands form the dry land. Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our God, our Maker, for He is our God, and we are His the people of His pasture and the sheep of His hand. Today, if you would hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the day of Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me. They tried me, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation, and said, they are a people who err in their heart, and they do not know my ways. Therefore I swore in my anger, truly they shall not enter into my rest. One thing you note when you read through this psalm is that the first part, the first 7 verses, are this praise and worship and adoring God, and then it kind of switches all of a sudden. You notice that in verse 7? Praising and worshiping, and then David says, today, if you hear my voice, obey. That has led some liberal theologians to say, well, this is obviously 2 psalms that have been pieced together. Obviously, they're 2 different things. What I'm going to propose to you today is that God is an amazing God who can write beautiful psalms through David, and both pieces match very well with this idea of trust. Trusting an awesome God and obeying Him. The old song, trust and obey, for there's no other way, comes to mind. One of the things that, when you think through trust, oftentimes a lack of trust is really hinged, connected to how you view God. A low view of God, and sometimes not even thinking about God, are often at the root. David is going to bring before us 2 characteristics, 2 essential characteristics of a heart that trusts. Because if you truly want to trust, and if you see down the future difficult times, maybe you're in difficult times now, every one of us can think through situations in which we don't trust the way we should. If you sit here and think that you don't struggle with your trust, let's think about how we couch words. You know, instead of being angry, most of the time we'll say, I was frustrated with that circumstance. That irritated me, when it really is anger. What about the lack of trust? Instead of worry, because that's sin, instead of being anxious, because that's sin, and the Bible tells us not to be those things, instead of those things, we're concerned about circumstances. I think this is applicable to all of our lives in every different setting. David is going to give us 2 keys, 2 characteristics of a heart that trusts. And that is a heart that worships God and a heart that obeys God. And I think you're going to see this. It really is a beautiful picture. And I encourage you to track along. The first point that we have is a heart that trusts God is one that worships Him for who He is. Seeing God as who He is and worshiping for that. The first characteristic that we see, and David's going to paint these characteristics for us, is in 1 and 2, He is the rock of our salvation. Let's look at it. Come, O come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before His presence with thanksgiving. Let us shout joyfully to Him with psalms. And what we see here is this call to come with exuberant worship, to sing, to shout, to be joyful, to offer up thanksgiving. But we would agree with that, right? We should approach God that way. But notice what He says. Shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation. And in Scripture, and particularly in the Old Testament, in the first few books of the Old Testament, rock signifies something spectacular in the life of, in the history of Israel. The rock is going to, this illustration of the rock is going to show God as being characterized of two things, provider and protector. Exodus 17, and we're going to look at this a little more in detail a little bit later on, but Exodus 17, that wilderness generation, just a side note, that generation cracks me up. If you read through Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, that wilderness generation, they are knuckleheads. Time and time again, they mess up. And this Jersey boy, who's been out here for 13 years, city kid, I used to look down at that wilderness generation. What were they thinking? I mean, they're idiots. And then I started thinking, what would I do if the Lord was traipsing me through Palmdale with no water? Would I complain? Yeah. About half an hour into it. I'm tired, I'm sweaty, I'm thirsty. Where are we going, Lord? Exodus 17, Israel has just come out of Egypt. God has parted the Red Sea. They pass through it. They see Pharaoh destroy the army. I'm sorry, they see God destroy Pharaoh's army. They're wandering through the wilderness. God provides manna, spam from heaven. God provides manna, this heavenly bread that actually is called, or it says it tastes like honey. They get water a number of times. They start traipsing through even more dry parts. There's no water to be around. They start to complain to Moses. So what does God do? God says, Moses, strike the rock. Now, theologians estimate that there probably was about 2 million people, roughly, Israel, with children, and women, and all the men. Imagine watering 2 million people. Now, this is desert. If you've ever been to a desert, it's not fun. And it's dry. And there's no water. And he strikes a rock. And you think it's like trickling out like a little fountain. People come up, take a little drink, and they move on. The psalmist in Psalm 78 says that when Moses struck the rock, it gushed out and the dry land became like ocean depths. I can't wait to see that. I hope I get to see it. A picture of what that looked like. Watering a nation in the desert. The rock provided physical salvation for Israel, which was a type that would later be shown as the rock of our salvation spiritually. But it's also described as, the rock is also described as something that protects. In Psalm 18, the Lord is our rock, and it signifies something that's a stronghold, a fortress, immovable. So David's painting this picture, be joyful, give thanks, praise Yahweh, who's the rock. The next one is this. He is the King of all kings. Look at verse 3. It isn't a very large verse. It doesn't say a lot, but what it does say, it says with great depth. For the Lord is a great king, or a great God, and a great king above all gods. And David's not saying that there are other gods, but God is above everything, even the so-called idols. Even the so-called gods. Now, I want to ask you a question. You can focus with me. When's the last time you thought of God as king? Really? Honestly. For me, it was during election night. And because I started to think through the millennial kingdom, the thousand-year reign of Christ, you know, he's going to be the greatest politician that's ever lived. The best the most righteous, with utmost integrity? How often do we think of God reigning as king? That He rules over His creation. That He is king above everything. Because oftentimes if we think of God as king, then we have to think of ourselves as less than king in our own lives. Humbly bowing in submission to the King of all kings. Just ask yourself that question. When's the last time you thought about God being king over everything and everyone? One of the most beautiful pictures painted in the Bible, I believe, is that one day every knee shall bow and every tongue confess. Are you excited about that? Like, are you excited about seeing Christ as king over everything? If you view God as a God who is your rock, who will provide and protect, if you view God as a God who is king, a righteous king over everything, you might trust Him a little bit more. But David doesn't stop there. He continues. He is the creator of everything, 4 through 6. Let's look at it. And I want you to notice a common theme here. In whose hand are the depths of the earth? The peaks of the mountain are His also. The sea is His, for it was He who made it, and His hands formed the dry land. Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker. Not only is He rock, not only the rock of our salvation, the King of all kings, but He's the creator of everything. Notice the language that the psalmist used, that David used. The depths of the earth are in His hand. Isn't that cool? Like, really, when you think about it. The depths of the earth are in His hand, and the mountain peaks are His also. And then what else does it say about His hands? They created the sea and the dry land. And then David points to not only are the depths in His hand and the mountain peaks, not only did He create the sea and the land, but He's our Maker. When you view God as creator of everything, that elicits worship. David says, come, let us bow down, let us kneel. Notice that in the first verse, or first two verses, it's let's shout joyfully. Let's come with excited adoration of God. And now he moves to, and not only are we to be excited and adore God, but humbly bow before Him. Because He's King and Creator. Isn't that cool? And think about that. That God holds everything in His hands. But I think the coolest thing is yet to come. Not only is He rock, king, and creator, but He's the shepherd of His people. Look at the language with which the writer uses. For He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture and the sheep of His hand. In verse 3, he says, God is a great God. Now what does he say? He is our God. In the previous verses, he says the depths of the earth are in His hand. And the peaks. By His hands, He separated the land and the sea. And if you're His sheep, you're in those hands. Isn't that cool? Think about that. The creator of the world. The hand that created is the hand that shepherds. Could you imagine if you really believed and lived with these truths? How you trust? God is rock, the provider and protector. He is the king. He is the creator, and He is the shepherd. Oftentimes, when we find ourselves not trusting, it's because we don't really believe those things about God. We might not verbally say, well, I don't believe he's the rock, and I don't believe he's king. I don't believe he created. We won't say that verbally, but we'll live that way. Think about it. If God can water 2 million people in the desert by a miracle of Moses hitting a rock, if God, who is the King of all kings, who rules over everything, if God, who is the creator of everything, even of you, and if you're His sheep, He is your shepherd, if this God is all these things, and He is, why don't we trust Him? That's a challenge. When our view of God is huge, when we see Him as high and lifted up, when we worship God, we have no choice but to trust Him. There's no other way. You think about that. When you worry and fret and are concerned, just like me, what's your view of God? The second is this. A heart that worships, or a heart that trusts, is a heart that worships, but it's also a heart that obeys Him in what He says. And notice the shift. He moves from worshiping God to the end of verse 7. Today, if you would hear His voice. And it really is natural. If you worship God, if you see Him as high and lifted up, as the rock of salvation, as the King of kings, as the creator of the world, as the shepherd of you, then naturally, you would obey, right? Jesus says, John 10, verse 27, "My sheep hear My voice, and they follow Me." The first thing we learn from here is this, if it comes up. Obedience and trust starts today. David writes in such a way that he throws today right at the very front. Today, he looks at the generation and he says, today, if you hear His voice, and here's the thing, God has been speaking to His people for centuries, through His Word particularly. But are His people listening? David challenges us. Obedience starts today. Not only that, obedience learns from past failures. Verses 8 and 9. Do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the day of Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers tested Me. They tried Me, though they had seen My work. It looks at the past. And we're going to actually walk through this a little bit, looking at the examples of the wilderness generation. But this in particular looks back at Exodus 17. And He says, today, this day, if you hear His voice, don't act like that generation who tested and tried God, who didn't believe Him, who didn't obey Him, who didn't trust Him. Oftentimes I think through my own life and I think through the times that I don't trust have been such an example to me. You find that for you? God, I don't know how this is going to happen. I don't know where you're going to take me. I don't know how you're going to provide. I don't know what's going to happen here. I'm concerned. What is the deal, God? You ever get like that? Maybe I'm the only one here. I'm the only sinner in the room. And then He does something pretty spectacular. Somehow, some way, there's provision, right? And then you walk a little bit. And something else happens. God, I don't know what's going to happen. What are you doing here? Things are falling around me. And then I'm reminded of, well, wasn't it just last week that I was saying the same thing? How did He provide? See, obedience learns from past failures, but they also keep in mind God's past faithfulness. We're going to see this in the wilderness generation. Lastly, in this section, disobedience has serious consequences. 10 and 11. For 40 years, I loathed that generation. Could you imagine if God said that about Church of the Canyons? For 40 years, I loathed COC because it wouldn't believe in trust. That makes it a little bit more personal, doesn't it? For 40 years, I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who err in their heart, and they do not know my ways. Therefore, I swore in my anger, truly they shall not enter my rest. God's serious about trusting Him. He is serious. And we're going to see that through the lessons and the examples of the wilderness generation. Let me paint a picture for you. Turn to Exodus 17. And as you're turning there, we're going to talk a little bit and be reminded about this generation. Exodus 17. We're going to look at three examples in particular that highlight the many failures of this people. Exodus 17. Now, to start with the generation of the wilderness people would kind of short-circuit a little bit of really understanding what this is all about. In Genesis chapter 12, God comes to Abraham and He says, go out of this land to a land that I'm going to show you. I'm going to bless you with many, many descendants. You're going to become a nation. I'm going to give you land and I'm going to bless people around you. We all remember that, right? Nice little Genesis story that we grew up in Sunday school. And then what happens? Fast forward through many generations. Now there's actually lots of people. God's been faithful to His promise to Abraham. There's many descendants, but they're living in Egypt and they're slaves. You remember a little flannograph, you know, in Sunday school? And they cry out to God. God hears them. God sends Moses. You picture Charlton Heston showing up, or maybe you've watched the cartoon, and Moses shows up. What happens? Now, think from the mind of an Israelite who's been held captive, who's been told God has promised a land. Moses shows up, says God's going to deliver you from Egypt. Yeah, how's He going to do it? Watch and see. 10 plagues, right? You remember 10 plagues. I'll list them off, but I wouldn't want any of those plagues, especially the boils. The boils kind of scare me. The last plague is particularly powerful. Because what does God do? He sends an angel of death that kills all the firstborn. Remember that? Except for the firstborn who lives in a house whose doorway is painted with blood. Egypt, having lost all of the firstborns, kicks Israel out. Literally shoves them out. Piles on silver and gold and livestock. And in a sense, Israel plunders them without having any military. And they walk out of Egypt. You're following with that, right? Now imagine you're an Israelite and you come up to the Red Sea and you look behind you and you say, oh, that's Pharaoh's army. They're coming to get us again. What are we going to do now? As you know the story, the sea parts. Now that's going to be pretty amazing, right, to see? I would love to see how that was done. The sea parted. They walked through. Pharaoh's army comes in. The sea collapses and kills them. Now listen to this. That generation also had a cloud by day that they followed and a pillar of fire by night that they followed. Visual demonstration that God was with them. So they go out into that wilderness. I wouldn't want to spend an hour there. They have nothing to eat, nothing to drink. Deuteronomy 8 says this, and I want you to pay close attention to what Deuteronomy 8 says. God tells Israel why He sent them to this wilderness. Because He could have taken them to Israel by boats, right? Up the Nile, over. He could have taken them a number of ways. Why did He send them through the wilderness? Deuteronomy 8 says this, I sent you to the wilderness, I let you be hungry, I let you thirst, so you'd be humbled. So you'd trust Me. So I could test what's in your heart to see if you trusted Me. And then the famous quote by Jesus, which happens in that same context, so that you can understand that man doesn't live by bread alone, but by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Why did He send them to the wilderness? To show them, first of all, that they're dependent on Him every step of the way. They couldn't plant a farm, could they, in the wilderness? Get water themselves? And he also tested what was in their hearts, whether they truly trusted him, whether they worshipped and obeyed. So they're wandering through. They have no food. So what does God do? He gives them manna. What is this? That's what they say. That's how they named it. What's this? Can you imagine? It almost seems a little insulting. Divine bread from heaven. The Bible tells us it looked like a wafer and it tasted like honey. They get manna every day. They pick it up. They don't have to bake it. They don't have to do anything to it. God provides for them. Then they wander a little further and there is some water. But guess what? This water you can't drink. You can't drink it. So God miraculously uses Moses to throw something into the lake or to the little puddle of water and it becomes drinkable. So they drank. They go a little bit further. They need water again. Again, same thing happens. They go a little bit further. There's no water now. What do? Exodus 17. They quarreled with Moses. Why don't you turn, if you haven't turned there, Exodus 17. And here's the situation. The people, they've seen all of these things that God has provided over and over and over again, yet they're thirsty. They want water. Verse 3. But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Moses had a tough time with these people. Over and over again, they try to kill him, they complain to him, this and that. I mean, I feel for him. They come and they complain, "Why, Moses, have you brought us out of Egypt to kill us here in the wilderness? We want water." But I want you to notice verse 7, because this is where the root issue is. Verse 7, he named that place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" What was the root issue here? They questioned whether God was even with them. Think about that. What did they just see in the last few months? 10 plagues? A sea parted? An army destroyed? Cloud by day? Pillar of fire by night? Manna from heaven every time they woke up in the morning? Water given to them numerous places? And yet they said, "Is God even here? Is he even with me?" How many times do you struggle with that? Maybe you don't. I know a lot of people that do. Is God even in this circumstance? Where is he? Why is he allowing me to do this? The first lesson is this. Trust that God will provide. Israel had the blessing of watching God provide time and time and time again, and yet they saw their future circumstances, something that maybe God couldn't do. Now imagine this, and this is where it's very convicting to me. Imagine this, if they viewed God as the rock of salvation, as the King of Kings, as the Creator of the world, as the Shepherd who leads them day in and day out, would they question, is God even here? See, a big view of God goes a long way in trusting Him. Reminding ourselves who this God is. They're going to challenge God even worse than this as we progress. But trusting that God will provide. You look at the economic situation. Where are we going to be in 2 years as a church? Is God going to provide? The answer is, has He provided? Has He? Have we been here for how many years? I've been here for 13. Is he going to provide? I have to remind myself that. What's going to happen to me? Am I going to be here in 2 years? God will provide. What's going to happen to your house, your job? Physically, what's going to happen to you? Will God provide? Well, the answer is yes. But you have to remember and remind yourself of the past faithfulness of God. Because past faithfulness is a testament to what He's going to do in the future. If He really is the Shepherd who holds us in His hand, Are you going to look at him and say, are you there? Are you even in this? Where are you? The second example is in Numbers 11. I'll paint the picture for you. Numbers 11. Well, they leave that area where God provided water from the rock. They travel and they hit Mount Sinai. Now think about this. The time that it took them to leave Egypt to the time to get to Mount Sinai to receive the law was 3 months. 3 months, that's all it was. And the time from Mount Sinai till the time they actually started to leave to go to the Promised Land was 9 months. And in that time, that's when the latter half of Exodus is. That's the whole book of Leviticus and the first 10 chapters of Numbers. All those books right there, last half of Exodus, all of Leviticus, and the first part of Numbers is 9 months. Sometimes we get this idea that, man, this was just going on forever and ever and ever. But this generation, they only had a year, a little over a year, of constantly walking away from God, questioning Him. They get the law. God tells them, I'm going to lead you by that same cloud and that same pillar of fire. Now, whenever that cloud lifts up or that pillar of fire lifts up, whenever that happens, you follow that and I'll guide you and I will be with you. They said, okay. Numbers 10, they start moving out. They're following it along the cloud or the pillar, depending on the time. And then Numbers 11. Numbers 11. It's fascinating. Verse 4. The rabble who are among them. Can you imagine if God called you rabble? The rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. Now, I want to stop there. Did you notice what he just described? Man, they had some stinky breath. Onions and leeks and garlic. What's the concern here? Let's read a little further. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna. Divine bread that you don't have to work for, that tastes like honey, that's provided to you every day. Now, I can understand a little bit. I probably would be one of those people like, hey, man, I want to spice up the menu here a little bit. Let's spice it up. I remember back in Egypt when it was a good menu. I mean, it was just a table set out and we had everything. But now I got to eat this honey wafer for over a year. You think you'd complain about eating the same thing every day for a year? Probably. But God looks at it as a heart that has greedy desires. We want meat. God eventually sends them quail. Now, here's the thing. If you get time, you can read the rest of the story. He sends them so much quail. He says, fine, you want meat? You don't want to be content with what I've provided you? You don't want to trust that I know what's best for you? Fine, I'll give you your meat, so much so that it's going to come out of your nostrils. Can you imagine if God said that to you? Fine, you want money? It's going to come out of your nose. Some of you are like, yeah, bring it. I'll pull that out. And the text says that those who had the greedy desires, who wanted more than what God had given them, died with meat in their mouth, stuffing their face. What's the lesson here? Trust sees God as giving you what you need. Being content with what you have. You know, half of this mess that we're in America is because people wanted more. Daddy wants the big house. I want more. Let me refinance, do some magic jumping around and get more that I can't pay for in 2 years. Being content with what you have. God is going to always provide. Oftentimes, though, our issue of trust isn't what He's provided, it's what we want. It's not enough. Anybody here struggle with that? I mean, honestly, anybody here struggle with that? I do. I'll be honest. But what are we blessed with? What am I blessed? I think I have the greatest job in the world. I get to hang out with college kids who love Jesus. I get to spend time with missionaries who want to serve God. I get to be in seminary. I get to do all these things. Am I content? I got a great apartment with a great wife and a dog. Am I content with what He's given me? It's hard, guys. I don't know if you struggle with that, but I do. And oftentimes it's because we don't see our God as King and Creator and Shepherd who knows exactly what we need, when we need it. We want more. That's not a heart of trust. That's a heart that has greedy desires. Are you convicted? Because I sure am. Preaching it twice is a doozy. Faithfully obey, knowing that God provides. Going to Numbers 13. Honestly, I love the Pentateuch, the first five books. There's so much here. And maybe one day I'll get to teach a Sunday class on the Pentateuch and really get to open it up. There's just so much here. But this is the pinnacle of this wilderness generation. Now follow this with me. Remember, they've seen all of these great signs, right? I mean, they've seen God bring them out of Egypt, send the 10 plagues, open up the seas, let the seas crash and kill Pharaoh, provide time and time again with water and manna, have a cloud in front of them at day, a pillar of fire at night. He is always there. He's always provided. Even when they ask for meat, He gives them meat. They get ready to go into the land. They end up at Kadesh Barnea. And that might not mean much to you, but to an Israelite it means a whole lot. Because Kadesh Barnea is like our 9/11. It's the moment that signified a lot in the nation of Israel. At Kadesh Barnea, God says, go into the land, look at the land that I'm going to give you. And they come back and they say, we ain't going in there. But all through this journey, God, over and over again, has said this. Exodus 33:2. I'm going to send an angel before you to take out the people in the land. Now, if you were an Israelite at that time and you heard an angel to take out somebody, your mind immediately goes back to the 10th plague and saw the devastation that that angel did on all the firstborn. And God says, I'm going to send an angel to take out those people. Leviticus 20:24 says this, I am going to give you this land if you trust and obey me. Leviticus 26:7-8 says, in essence, one of you, if you trust and obey me and go into that land and see all these people, one of you will drive away 100. That's some good odds, huh? And then he says, 100 of you will chase 10,000 by the sword. Over and over and over again, God reminds Israel, go into the land, I will do this. Verse 1 and 2. God says, gather up those spies, send them into the land, have them check it out. I'm going to give you this land. Go scope it out, see the people, see the cities, see the land itself. So the 12 spies go. They come back. They bring with them some produce of the land. Why? Because the people want to know, is this really a land flowing with milk and honey, so to speak? Does this land really produce? They bring back these things. In fact, the text says they put a cluster of grapes on a pole. That's some big grapes. They bring it back. The people look at it and they say, yeah, this land indeed has productivity. God is telling the truth. This land is a land flowing of milk and honey. But then the spies say, yeah, the land is just the way God said it would be. But there's some big hosses over there. Those guys are so big. Come on, ask me how big they are. They're so big. I'm like a little grasshopper in their sight. A little grasshopper. They're huge. I mean, just imagine, the people are so big and they're strong and we're scared. And Caleb, remember Caleb, right? If not, you can read about Caleb. I want to meet him. He is a cool, cool guy. Caleb says, let's go in there. Let's whoop up. And later on in the book of Judges, he's an old man. An old man. And he's whipping up on the people in the land when they finally go in. And God says that Caleb had a different spirit. One who literally followed God fully. But the people say, yeah, we're not going in there. We are not going in there. I want you to read their response in chapter 14. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, would that we have died in the land of Egypt, or would that we have died in this wilderness. By the way, that actually happens, right? Careful what you ask for, both with meat and how you die. Why is the Lord bringing us into the land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Here's the situation. They just get this report. They start crying and weeping and moaning and grumbling. The whole group of people, 12 million or 2 million people probably estimate. Weeping, groaning, we can't do it. And then they get mad at Moses. And they say, Moses, why did you bring us out here to die? And later on, the text says that they picked up stones to kill Moses. Now, I don't know about you, but some things don't set right with me on this. You're going to kill Moses, appoint another leader, and walk back to Egypt. Does that strike anybody as odd? Like, how are they going to cross the Red Sea? Do you wonder that? Push a button. Woo. It's not an amusement ride. What happens when they get to Egypt? Hey, we're home. What are they going to do? It's idiotic. But they're so scared that they'll do even the idiotic. Right? But notice something even more serious. They accuse the character of God. See, rather than seeing Him as the rock, as the king, as the creator, and as the shepherd, what do they say? Look at it. Verse 3. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, how long will this people spurn me? How long will they not believe in me despite all the signs which have been performed in their midst? Trusting God to provide. Being content with what God has provided. And then this. Trusting and obeying even when everything around you seems to scream, don't. It's hopeless. It's impossible. If I was one of those Israelites, and I'm not, and I'm glad, because I probably would be laid low in the wilderness, because I would grumble, and I would complain. I wouldn't be content with a year's supply of manna, or even a year's supply of spam, for that matter. And if I heard that the people across the way would kill us, would I believe in God? If He says, I'm going to give this to you, this is yours, I'm going to send an angel. Now, a lot of us would say, yeah, man, we believe. I don't know what those people are like, but I'm telling you what. Get us Southern California comfortable Americans in the wilderness and let's see what we do. Let's see if we would obey. Let's see if we would trust. Let's see if we would see our God as high and lifted up. Let's see if we would say, where's the water? But I do that. Do you? I mean, really, you think about it. Do you? God, why don't I have what I want? Are you really going to provide? And when God calls us, whether individually or as a congregation, to move in a direction, Will we faithfully go? Because here's that old saying, where God guides, He also provides. He does. It's a challenge, I think, to trust God. We like to be comfortable. We like to not be in situations in which we have to trust God. But just like that wilderness generation, God will allow this congregation and you individually to go through trying times like the wilderness generation to see if your heart will trust Him. Sometimes to convict us when it doesn't. To challenge us to view Him as awesome. As the shepherd who will always give us what we need, even if we're not content. Let's pray. Father, we're just so thankful for Your Word and even the challenge it is to trust You. I pray that we would, in these challenging times, and in a future that seems so uncertain, so bleak, so doom and gloom, Father, may we grab onto the only thing that will remain firm, You, the Rock, the King, the Creator, and our Shepherd. In Your Son's name, amen. Have a wonderful Sunday.